So good evening, everyone. Good to see you all. This is the second of our series of, I guess we're calling them Dharma seminars, that we're calling practices for nurturing connection. Last week, Michael talked about gratitude. Did anyone do some gratitude practice last week? Any comments for those?
It was wonderful.
Yeah?
Yeah, the homework.
Say a little about it for those who weren't here.
I think you kind of said maybe go a little bit further in expressing gratitude, and even to a tree. So I thanked some trees. Mostly it was people. But.
Yeah. So the take-home practice was not only to notice and cultivate gratitude, but actually to express it. Yeah. Anybody else? Any comments? Even noticing it, one practice Michael suggested was to write down three things at the end of the day, even small things, really small things. But it shifts from that mind of complaint, I find, quite nicely. That mind of dwelling on lack, what's wrong, what's missing, what's not enough. Yeah. So maybe that links up in some way that I haven't really articulated to myself yet, but we'll find out with the topic I've chosen for tonight, which is trust, and by extension, faith. I suppose you could argue that trust cannot rightly be called a practice, and that there are practices that support or develop and strengthen trust, maybe. You could say trust, well, you either have it or you don't. You feel it or you don't, maybe. And then what about faith? It's not so clear what the difference is. That's one thing I've been trying to sort out. Trust versus faith. We can say they both involve a feeling of confidence in someone or something as reliable, true, effective, good. And generally speaking, we tend to associate the word faith more with religious beliefs. But we'll come back to that. Before I go any further, I want you to kind of spontaneously write down some of your own associations with these two words, okay? And then we'll come back to them. So, get your pens ready, and I'm going to just ask you some questions. And just write down, maybe the first three things that come to mind without thinking too hard. What or whom do you trust? And I will say these are not to share with anybody. These are for yourselves. And these could be quite long lists, but I'll just ask you to write down just the first few things that come to mind. Next question is, what or whom do you not trust? Thank you. Okay, and before this turns into a really long list, which it could easily for most of us, what do you base trust upon? Okay, next one. When has your trust been broken or betrayed? Again, maybe pick three. Just, you know, don't have to make your whole life list, but you know, three things that come to mind. And last question is, what do you have faith in? Okay, so I'm sure, you know, there's probably much more we could write about this, but let's all just put our list down for now, set them aside, come back to them. And I'd just like to mention what brought this topic up for me. I was thinking about, of course, what are the greatest barriers to connection? Because we're talking about practices that support connection and kind of penetrate that sense of separation that, or dissolve that sense of separation that we so often feel from others, from the world, from ourselves. And what are the, you know, what are the greatest barriers? And for me, I'd say distrust is right up there, one of the greatest barriers to connection. So it would follow that trust would foster connection. So I wanted to look more into trust. Now, so my first thing is, you know, to go to the bookshelf. When I looked on our rather extensive bookshelf of Dharma literature, I found very little on trust. More on faith, because as we've said, that's the word that's more used in religious or spiritual contexts. There's more about trust in the language of psychology. So I went to a different shelf. And on that shelf, I found a substantial book, over 300 pages, called Trust After Trauma, A Guide to Relationships for Survivors and Those Who Love Them, by Aphrodite Matsakis, who is a psychotherapist who specializes in post-traumatic stress and childhood trauma, and she's worked extensively with war veterans. So she's talking about, you know, when trust is broken, damaged, and how to restore a sense of trust in others, trust in life. So I'll come back to that. Ultimately, we need to be able to trust others to function effectively as social beings in the world, right? If we had no trust in others, we couldn't set foot at our door in the morning. We couldn't cross the street trusting that most people follow the rules of the road and will not run us down. Note that I say most people. Right? Not everyone does drive in a considerate, mindful way, observing the laws and conventions designed to keep in check our self-centered need to get where we're going as fast as possible. Who among us always drives the actual speed limit? Mm-hmm. All the time. Who among us always comes to a full stop at a stop sign? Or never runs a yellow light? It's a slippery slope. And because we know this about ourselves and our fellow human beings, our trust is tempered by caution. And it should be. Trust is shaped by our experience. It can be built, and it can be damaged, and it can be repaired. We come into this world as infants, trusting, I think naturally, trusting, open and receptive. Though it's possible that some prenatal experiences might predispose us to some anxiety, but mostly we come into the world trusting. Initially, we want comfort and nourishment, and if we get them, we're content. And pretty much from the beginning, we also want connection. We begin to explore our world and make contact, first with the person who is our primary provider of comfort and nourishment, most often our mother. We make contact through our senses, our skin, our eyes, ears, nose, tongue, and mouth. And the world makes contact with us in a reciprocal flow, which is most intense and vivid with our primary caregiver initially. We gradually grasp that there are objects around us in the world that come and go, and that they're separate from us somehow, and that they exist even when we can't see them. That's a big breakthrough in cognitive development for children, right? To realize that when you leave the room, when someone leaves the room, particularly the caregiver, that there's a mental image that remains constant, that we know they're still there and they'll come back. That's a building of trust. It's called, that cognitive ability is called object constancy, and it develops between usually 2 and 3 years of age. We can watch this in toddlers. As they become more mobile, they venture out on their own, start exploring the world, and then they come back and check in with whoever's taking care of them, and then venture out again, back and forth. Yep, still there, it's okay. And then I can go out again. Building the trust that their parent will be there and meet their needs is crucial to their development, along with building trust in their own ability to explore and make contact with the wider world. The child naturally learns what is pleasant and unpleasant, what hurts, what to avoid, and how to seek comfort and reassurance when something frightening has happened. This is part of what child development theory calls forming secure attachments. Back in the 1960s and 70s, there was a developmental psychologist, Mary Ainsworth, who conducted some pioneering studies of interactions between children and their mothers, which is something Freud never did. He never actually observed children. In her experiment, she called her experiment the infant strange situation. And in the experiment, a mother and a baby were placed in a room with some toys for the babies to crawl around and investigate. And then a stranger comes into the room and sits down. Then the mother goes out of the room for a while. And then the mother comes and the baby reacts to that in whatever way, and then usually with some degree of upset. Then the mother comes back, and then the key thing to observe was how the children would react to the mother returning. There were four patterns of attachment that were observed. One was called secure attachment, and that was when the child, when the mother returned, the child was quickly soothed. The child went up to the mother and quickly calmed down and then went back out and started playing with the toys. So they felt safe and comforted. Second pattern was called avoidant attachment. In this pattern, the child would kind of ignore the mother when she came back in, not make eye contact, kind of turn away. And this pattern seemed to be associated with mothers who had a kind of dismissive or inattentive way of being with the child. So the child learned not to seek comfort, to kind of withdraw into themselves. Third pattern was what was called anxious or ambivalent attachment. In this pattern, the child would be quite clingy when the mother returned, but wouldn't soothe easily and wouldn't go back out to play with the toys, would stay upset. And often in this pattern was associated with mothers who had a high level of anxiety themselves and were unable to regulate themselves. And the fourth pattern was called disorganized attachment, in which the child would, and this was the hardest for the observers to see, the child would behave in sort of chaotic, even self-harming ways, throwing itself about and or else kind of just staring and freezing. And this tended to be associated with mothers who had some trauma in their lives or had been abusive to the child or were dissociated. So the mother was almost frightening to the child and the child frightening to the mother. And there was a much smaller percent. About 75% of the children were in that secure attachment pattern. And the researchers later found that there were quite strong correlations between these attachment patterns and the mother's own relationships to their mothers or parents. But only about 75% of the time, so it wasn't completely consistent. And other researchers found correlations between these patterns and the children's later social adjustment or lack of social adjustment in adolescence or early adulthood. But again, it wasn't a 100% correlation. So the speculation being that although childhood experience is quite powerful and influential on our development, it's modified by later experiences, both damaging and repairing. So insecure attachment can be strengthened by later experiences of loving and caring relationships. And even secure attachment can be jeopardized by sustained abuse or trauma, or wartime trauma, for example. So all this is about the building or damaging of trust, you know, in our relationships and in our world. And it's encouraging, I think, to know that even damaged trust can be healed. Now, you might be wondering, with all this talk about attachment, isn't Buddhism supposed to be about non-attachment? And no self? You've heard these phrases. Well, it's been said you have to have a self to lose the self. You have to have a functioning self-structure that's flexible and resilient in order to let go of self-focus and self-clinging. So, for example, a child who has that pattern of clinging and insecurity and anxiety, that's going to be harder, taking that pattern into adulthood, to let go of self-focus, defensiveness, and self-clinging. We have to be able to form wholesome connections and relationships in order to know when to let go and when to engage more closely. Now, because there are always times in our lives as we go through different stages of life where we have to let go of relationships. Children grow up, leave home, start their own lives in the world. We have to, as parents, be able to let go, let them go gracefully, but still maintain the connection, right? And of course, we have losses when people die in our lives, and we have to be able to integrate that into our life experience without losing our trust in life itself. We have to be able to let go. So here's where our practice comes in. Awareness of body, heart, and mind in the moment is a tremendous asset in our ability to assess a given situation or person in our life accurately and know how much to trust. Right? We trust some people with our money, we trust someone else with our plumbing, and we trust someone else with our heart. Right? But we don't necessarily trust everybody completely. And that's okay. We have to use what's called discriminating wisdom. Being kind and open-hearted doesn't mean we should be blindly trusting of what can harm us or what can harm others. But we also have to develop a capacity to be vulnerable. Anyone who's ever had their trust betrayed, especially repeatedly, knows that our behavior, our views, can be distorted by that experience. Whether it's a car accident, or a broken love relationship, or abusive behavior by someone close to us, or persistent illness, or losses through death, we can become hypervigilant, looking out for what's going to hit us next. Right? We lose our trust in others or in life, and we generalize. Men who remind us of our father or women of our mother. Or we might not trust people of a particular race or ethnicity. We might not trust realtors or Zen teachers, right? Depending on our experiences. Sometimes we lose our trust in our bodies as healthy and reliable. Or in life, when the hard knocks come, thick and fast. So again, here's where our practice supports us. Not to turn away from our own experience, from our own pain, to feel it, to grieve it if necessary, but not to let it become our identity. Not to reduce it and say this is, to let it narrow our view, narrow our sense of possibility. Our practice helps us to open again and again and again to the gifts of the gifts and the possibilities of right now, this person right in front of us, this experience now. So with a lot of patience and a lot of kindness to ourselves, we can become closely acquainted with our, what we might call our trust issues, and know that they have roots in causes and conditions. And we can somehow discover a deeper trust in our freedom to be fully present with what in Dharma we call our true nature, a kind of that's not bounded by our what we could call our karmic life. Here's where something closer to what we think of as faith arises. Many people who have experienced faith as a demand for unquestioning allegiance to a particular creed or set of beliefs, particularly those who might have felt betrayed by the institutions or individuals in authority within a religious tradition, can have a deep distrust of faith. I myself grew up in my early years in the Baptist church, and we had a hymn that we sang, and the chorus went, "Trust and obey, for there's no other way to be happy in Jesus but to trust and obey." Well, I wasn't really into obedience, and so I didn't really buy into that formulation. Vipassana teacher Sharon Salzberg, American Vipassana teacher, has written this lovely book, really, called Faith, Trusting in Your Own Deepest Experience. And she says, if faith depends on believing what we are told, when those beliefs fall apart, we are left with nowhere to stand. And then she gives this rather poignant example. A friend of mine began to feel uncomfortable maintaining the Santa Claus myth with her growing daughter and decided to tell her the truth. She explained that the presents under the tree on Christmas morning were put there by her parents. The child listened to this information, then sadly left the room. A few minutes later, she returned to inquire, "Are you the tooth fairy too?" Her mother said yes. And again the child left, looking sad. Soon she returned with the question, "Are you the Easter bunny too?" Her mother said yes. The child looked at her fiercely and demanded, "Is there a God?" Perhaps you wouldn't want to be in the mother's shoes right then. She goes on to say, if the beliefs crumble, are we bereft of all refuge? Does critical exploration of our beliefs leave us vulnerable and unsure? How can we wholeheartedly have faith rather than a handful of beliefs? And what's kind of remarkable about Buddhist practice is that the Buddha gives us license to try it out in our own experience. He says, don't believe what I say just because I believe it. Try it out. Test it in your own experience, and if it leads to ease, well-being, and freedom from suffering, then embrace it, practice it. And if not, don't. Although He did, there was a certain caveat. He also said, and pay attention to what those who are wise, how those who are wise conduct themselves. The kind of faith born of direct experience, Sharon Salzberg calls verifying faith. Verifying faith. She says we might start our practice, our meditation practice, kind of like a love relationship. We're inspired by what we read, or by a teacher, or by an initial experience at a retreat. And this is what she calls bright faith. But bright faith doesn't often last. Past the honeymoon period, or the first rough patch, or the first dry spell in your practice, or in a close relationship. So we need a faith that tests and confirms our practice, and that's what verifying practice is. Can we really take refuge in Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha? We have to see for ourselves. And then gradually our faith matures into what Salzberg calls abiding faith. Abiding faith, she says, does not depend on borrowed concepts. Rather, it is the magnetic force of a bone-deep, lived understanding, one that draws us to realize our ideals, walk our talk, and act in accord with what we know to be true. So I think this kind of gradual maturing of faith is into abiding faith is where trust and faith meet. Doubts may still arise, and life might knock us to our knees again. But there's some substrate, I think of it, as something we can't deny, something that's kind of incontrovertible, and yet it's not solid. It's not something we can grasp. What words would we even give it? What reminds you that you are more than your small self, your story of grievances and hurts? What do you have faith in? Without a deity, without a creed, what do you have faith in? So I'm not going to give you the answer to that, but to invite you to hold that question, kind of just let that question percolate in the coming week, and as particularly when challenges and doubts arise, what is faith for you, and what do you trust? So. What I'd like you to do is just glance back at your lists and just see if there's anything, looking back on your list, that you would add or modify. Just take a minute, and then we're just going to just get in small groups and have just a little bit of discussion. Okay?